Today, stagflation looms as central bankers party amid peak uncertainty. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of those posts covering finance and property news. Today we're going to discuss the upcoming Jackson Hole bun fight and New Zealand Reserve Bank's decision to cut rates. And I'm going to argue that the whiff of stagflation is getting stronger to the detriment of ordinary households and businesses around the place. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand cut the official cash rate by 25 basis points, citing tighter spending by businesses and households, falling home prices, and uncertainty in the outlook for global economic policy, despite the real risk of inflation running above 3%, which is way above their target. And they now think the current rate is around neutral. An easing bias was maintained. The policy assessment maintains the key last sentence that if medium-term inflation pressures continue to ease as projected, the committee expects to lower the official cash rate further. And the New Zealand dollar slipped more than 1% to its lowest level since the middle of April. However, not all risks are tilted to the downside, with inflation not being as well behaved as the bank would like to see. So if inflation fails to moderate to the extent that they envision, this could limit the extent of monetary stimulus the Reserve Bank of New Zealand will be able to provide, which is the theme that we're seeing more broadly across central banks. For example, the Bank of England cut the cash rate last week, despite inflation coming in hot this week, with food up close to 5% and overall inflation expected to touch 4%, while growth remains weak and the cost of government debt rises. Inflation in the US also looks to be turning higher, as the core consumer price index, which excludes food and fuel, rose in July by the most since the start of the year. Yet the costs of tariff-exposed goods didn't rise as much as feared yet. But there are recent weaker signs from the jobs market, and recent producer price data confirms the inflation uptick, so the tariffs are expected to begin to hit consumers later. But with inflation still above the Fed's 2% goal, and signs of a slowdown in the labour market, policymakers have become divided on when to resume rate cuts. And in Australia, the inflationary pulse is stronger than hoped, despite recent rate cuts amid massive government spending. So all of this has the whiff of stagflation, where prices rise, wages fall, and interest rates are caught in the gap. And it also poses the question as to the real effectiveness of monetary policy, especially when governments continue to boost money supply, an act which is directly inflationary. Now, this is something which should be on the agenda at Jackson Hole this week for the Kansas City Fed's annual economic policy symposium, which kicks off later on Thursday, with central bankers from around the world gathering in Wyoming to discuss monetary policy. A handful of economists will present new research papers during the meeting, and there's usually a panel featuring heads of some of the world's biggest central banks, not all of it open to the public, of course. The highlight is likely to be Jerome Powell's speech on Friday. That's his last one at the annual gathering as Fed chairman, with investors searching for hints for a September cut before expectations soared in the wake of a surprisingly soft payrolls at the start of the month. Now, he could provide some insight into whether the Fed is poised to lower borrowing costs in September, or he may not. The Fed is caught in a dilemma about whether to lower the federal funds rate, driving down borrowing costs on all kinds of loans. Powell's reaction function to recent stagflationary data will be key, said analysts at Bank of America in a note. Will he be spooked by jobs revisions or lean into the labour supply slowdown? And in fact, the Federal Open Market Committee meetings that were released yesterday showed that there was still significant concern about the path of future inflation. Participants generally pointed to risks to both sides of the committee's dual mandate, emphasising upside risk to inflation and downside risk to employment. A majority of participants judge the upside risk to inflation as the greater of the two risks, which of course suggests that rate cuts aren't coming. Powell's speech is also likely to cover the Fed's ongoing policy framework review, which could have longer-term implications for monetary policy. The framework is a set of strategies that guide the Fed's decisions on interest rates. Economists expect Powell to discuss whether the Fed is reconsidering its approach to targeting inflation. Currently, the Fed's strategy is to use monetary policy to keep inflation at an average of 2% a year over time. Controversially, back in 2020, the Fed adopted a flexible averaging inflation targeting strategy, meaning that if inflation ran under 2% for a period of time, it would tolerate higher than 2% inflation for a while, which proved a little wobbly through the COVID period and beyond. The high-profile conference is also a chance for Powell and other officials to assert the central bank's independence from direct control of the White House. As it's currently set up, the president does not control interest rates and has only limited authority to change the makeup of the committee in charge of them. In recent months, President Donald Trump has challenged that status quo, demanding that the Fed lower interest rates and threatening to fire Powell. And he's even threatened to take legal action against Powell and other Fed officials, turning up the pressure on policymakers to either follow his lead or quit. The president's most recent targets have been Fed Governor Lisa Cook, with Trump demanding her resignation over allegations made by one of his political allies about mortgages he holds in Michigan and Georgia. This year's Jackson Hole Symposium arrives, therefore, at a complicated moment for global markets, said Daniela Hawthorne, senior market analyst at Capital.com. As policymakers descend on Wyoming's high-altitude think tank, expectations are skewed heavily towards a dovish message. But with inflation reaccelerating and political pressures swirling, markets could be setting themselves up for a sharp, hawkish surprise. Which takes us back quite nicely to New Zealand. And by the way, the acting governor there will not be at Jackson Hole, I note. The central bank's latest forecasts show a good chance for two more quarter point cuts by the first quarter, revising earlier projections that had implied one more cut by early next year. The decision to cut was widely expected by economists and markets. The unsurprising interest cut on Wednesday was followed by a surprisingly dovish statement, though, with a 50 basis point cut considered, sending the country's two-year yield down 16 basis points at one point as traders readjusted their rate expectations. That was good news for investors betting on curve steepening, a popular strategy that profits when the gap between long-term and short-term bond yields increases. New Zealand's 30-year yields fell by around 7 basis points now. In the press conference, the easing government spending was confirmed as providing capacity for the Reserve Bank of New Zealand to cut rates. And home prices are still seen as easing further.
The Minister of Finance just spoke in Parliament saying that the government's disciplined spending has given the Reserve Bank room to reduce the official cash rate. I'm just curious how much that is the case.
We mentioned in our record of meeting that we did discuss the fiscal outlook. It is one where government spending as a proportion of all activity is falling through our projection period. So in that sense, it's part of reducing inflation pressures. That's also consistent with what we had in May, because we don't have any new information since the May budget.
So it does help?
Yes.
Thank you. And just to follow up, you mentioned that there are downside risks to economic growth with the behaviour of households and businesses perhaps being a bit more cautious. How much does that play into your decisions? And have you noticed that there has been a significant change in the behaviour of households and businesses and their spending habits?
Well, what we have noticed is that economic activity in Q2 was considerably weaker than we expected. We knew that we had the Liberation Day 2nd of April announcements around tariffs internationally, and that there was a lot of uncertainty and a lot of sort of anxiety about how that could play out and how that could escalate. We've ended up in avoiding the worst case scenario. There hasn't been the escalation that there could have been. And some of those measures of global policy uncertainty have actually been falling more recently. But despite that, there has been this cautiousness in businesses and consumers, and it has lingered longer than we had anticipated. And so that's some of the thinking around whether those sectors have just become too cautious and need a bit more of a lift than we had expected.
I think the other interesting factor there is around house prices. Normally we'd expect house prices to be increasing a bit more at this point in the cycle, but they're not. We're not expecting them to increase a great deal over the coming 18 months. Also, and when you look at household consumption, it's very highly correlated with changes in what's going on in the housing market. So there's a bit of an open question there. Yeah. You know, can the New Zealand economy grow without that sort of wealth effect coming through the house
yeah. panel? But one of the key things that we also need to consider is that the 250 basis point cuts that we've now done, we've probably seen 50% of that transmit through. So there's another 50% still to go. So there's certainly more stimulation still to come that will support freeing up of disposable income at a household level and eventually feed into house prices and residential construction as a consequence of that as well.
So we do see growth going yeah. forward. Like, we've got a negative number in there for Q2, a small positive for Q3,
yeah.
And then back into reasonable growth from the end of this year.
Yeah.
And they also discuss the multi-speed state of the New Zealand economy and the extent to which monetary policy is working or not, and the impact of low net migration on the economy too. I discussed this the other day.
Earlier this year, the bank published a study on the pass-through rate of interest rate of OCR changes on a sector by sector basis. Are you able to give us some indication of which sectors you would expect to see the impact of today's decision appear in?
Paul, would you like
sure.
to speak to that?
Yeah, I have a crack at that. Like, one of the, you know, obviously export prices have been very high in the New Zealand economy recently. So sort of outward looking sectors, the ag sector, have been a source of growth, whereas those more inward-looking parts of the economy, you know, have been lagging. So we've got quite a mixed picture, as the Governor was saying. It's a multi-speed economy at the moment, which isn't unusual. So going forward, we would expect lower interest rates to show up in things like investment and residential investment and consumption. And you can, you know, on an industry by industry basis, you know, what industries are sort of leaning into that those parts of the economy, and you know, that would be retail, et cetera. So yeah, we are seeing monetary policy is working. It is passing through. It's affecting mortgage rates and deposit rates. And it is showing up on the real side. You know, growth was pretty reasonable end of last year and the beginning of this year. We've hit a bit of a judder bar, as we say in this country. A key issue for the Monetary Policy Committee is how long is that going to persist. We think it will. We will get through it because of lower interest rates, and we will see that in things like residential investment and consumption, which is a huge part of this economy.
The other thing is, it's not just interest rates that will drive the outcomes in some of those sectors. Paul's certainly talking about the ones that are more interest rate sensitive. There's no doubt about that. But if you think about housing in Auckland, population growth is a significant impact as well on what's happening with housing in the Auckland region. So low net working age immigration is very low. So that is having its own impact, in particular where we've got an economy that has focused on increasing supply at the same time. So there's lots of different factors that fit into these things, and monetary policy is only one of them.
It's super interesting at the moment because, you know, the housing market, we're not seeing house prices increase, as Karen was saying. Maybe, you know, we're seeing it more on the supply side. So increases in demand will lead to more residential investment. That could be part of low interest rates, part of low population growth. population growth is very low, and house prices and population growth have been sort of key drivers of economic growth in this economy for decades. So it really gets us back to the issue of productivity growth. If we want to sort of get growth going forward in the long run, then it's about improving productivity in this economy. And monetary policy is not the instrument for that. We're about controlling demand to keep inflation low and stable. There's only so much we can do.
And they also discuss the impact of consumer behaviour on the real impact of their rate-cutting cycle and the swing to households spending more on non-discretionary rather than discretionary areas, plus, of course, low demand for credit.
Have you paused and thought back as to why the transmission to date of 250 basis points has been so weak and so slow?
Yeah, we have. We have been definitely looking at that, and there's, in fact, a whole section on that in the monetary policy statement this time around. There's a couple of things that we would probably call out. The first of those is consumer behaviour itself. So, if we think about what's actually happening in terms of refixing mortgage rates, people have opted to stay in shorter terms, so on demand or up to 6 months, at much higher rates in the belief that they would come lower before they started to move out. So as that happens, it means your transmission is actually slower than you would anticipate. That's changing. So what we're now seeing is households move to refix for longer terms at much lower rates, and that's why we see the average stock rate coming down over the next 12 months. So, you know, if we saw it peak at 6.4, it's probably running around about 5.6 now, and it'll be in 12 months' time slightly below 5. So there's that aspect of it coming through. The second aspect to it is in terms of disposable income in what we'd say lower household or slowing household income profile, is what's happening with some of the more essential items that a household needs to continue to pay for. So what's happening with electricity prices? What's happening with rates? What's happening with food prices? So you're getting a little bit more contraction there. So money is going from discretionary spending into maintaining what they would regard as essential requirements that they need to do. So there's a little bit of that going on as well.
And a bit of labour market.
Does that make you have pause for thought about whether you need to tweak the mechanisms, whether you need to tweak your communication in order to perhaps get better, more immediate effect of the decisions that you take, notwithstanding that it takes you 9 months, 12 months flow through?
Yeah.
What I'd emphasise is that we've known for a long time that monetary policy lags along in variable, and monetary policy works through different channels and different times and different speeds. When I started in this role, 2019, interest rates were low and people were talking about they're not effective, you're pushing on a string, you won't get any increase in economic activity. And we've learnt that when you do move to those extremes, you do have an impact on the economy. We've felt it at the top and we've felt it at the bottom. It's just that there's a lot of uncertainty about how quickly these things will work through. I think that's what gives us the confidence that monetary policy, when we say monetary policy works, we say that interest rates lower or higher do have an impact, and you've just got to have confidence it will work its way through. The challenge is there will be other things that go on along the way.
Exactly.
And that's where we need to constantly readjust and recalibrate about whether we've done enough or whether we need to do more, and particularly in the zone that we're in at the moment, where we've done a lot in a rapid period. Now we start feeling our way.
Look, a great example was Q4, end of Q4 last year, Q1 this year, where we were seeing consumption up, investment up. We then got hit with it's an uncertainty shock, is what I would call happened at the beginning of Q2, and you saw that kind of external impact contract and pull that back. Now we're looking for it to, as that starts to wane, that we believe that monetary policy, the continuing transmission that we're seeing, will continue to have the impact that we were starting to see over the end of last year and into the early part of this year.
Now, all up, a broad range of indicators suggest that significant spare capacity in the New Zealand economy persists, with a slightly larger margin of spare capacity than in the May monetary policy statement. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand does remain broadly comfortable that spare capacity in the economy will be sufficient to drive overall inflation down towards 2% eventually. Near-term forecasts for CPI, though, are expected to be higher, with a 3% peak in Q3, but then they expect to ease back towards 2% by early 2026. Well, we'll see about that. Most of the changes were related to tradable CPI prices, with non-tradable inflation continuing to decline at an aggregate level at least. This is not, though, without risk, given the stickiness inherent in core inflation and the upward drift in some inflation expectation measurements. Among the special topics included in the MPS was a deep dive on why consumer spending has failed to fire despite those official cash rate cuts over the past 12 months. Catalysts include weak household income growth and low immigration. And the Reserve Bank of New Zealand assumes that lower interest rates transmit to spending, income and wealth over the coming year, broadly in line with historical relationships. But given that house prices have been lower than expected over the past year, there is some risk that house price growth remains subdued and consumption growth will be lower as a result. Outside of the elevated terms of trade, it's actually hard to detect many growth tailwinds, and there is the need for increased policy support to jumpstart the New Zealand economy. Every official cash rate decision before the end of the year looks to be effectively live. Even with official cash rate settings at three-year lows, 3% is not particularly stimulatory. In the context of neutral official cash rates, somewhere around the 3.3%, which was the Q3 Reserve Bank of New Zealand central estimate, but that's only approximate anyway. ASB tweaked its official cash rate outlook and expects a 2.5% cash rate by the end of the year, with a further 50 basis points of cuts. That's 25 basis points in October and then again in November, and a 2.5% official cash rate. They argue that monetary policy is the right tool for the right time. Treasury's recent analysis highlighted the need to restore fiscal buffers given their erosion since the global financial crisis and future fiscal needs. So this leaves few policy levers outside of pushing the official cash rate further below its neutral levels. But the complex stagflationary light environment that we are experiencing should pose questions both in New Zealand and for central bankers and their role more broadly. So in closing, I do note that countries where the central bank is more under the direct control of the president typically submits to pressure to lower interest rates, and according to several studies, they have higher rates of inflation and poorer economic performance. In fact, according to a recent Brookings Institute commentary called "Why is the Federal Reserve Independent and What Does That Mean in Practice?", they say central banks in nearly all major capitalist democracies are similarly insulated. Elected governments set the central bank's mandate, but the central banks have the freedom to deploy their tools, primarily interest rates, to achieve that mandate. The rationale is that elected politicians will tend to favour lower interest rates now to boost the economy, but this comes at the expense of more inflation later, and that's not in the best interests of the overall economy. Independent central bankers, the argument goes, can make unpopular decisions such as rising interest rates when circumstances demand. And academic research supports the case that economies with independent central banks tend to have lower and less volatile inflation rates, although just look back over the past 5 years and you may question that. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, who's now at Brookings, by the way, put it like this in a 2010 speech: policymakers in a central bank subject to short-term political influence may face pressures to overstimulate the economy to achieve short-term output and employment gains that exceeds the economy's underlying potential. Such gains may be popular at first and thus helpful in an election campaign, but they're not sustainable and soon evaporate, leaving behind only inflationary pressures that worsen the economy's longer-term prospects. Thus, political interference in monetary policy can generate undesirable boom-bust cycles that ultimately lead to both a less stable economy and higher inflation. But I would add that even central banks have done a really, really bad job in recent times, and they are part of the problem, not the solution. The stagflationary whiffs are getting stronger, and ordinary households and businesses are copping the flak. So central bankers need to be held to account, and yet currently, as the party at Jackson Hole gets underway, they are not. And that's a problem. And of course, the impact of their decisions on ordinary households and businesses is where the buck should stop. But it doesn't. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.